And now for today's introduction. We are joined by Dr. Jonathan Betlinski, professor in the Department of Psychiatry at Oregon Health and Science University. He is also director of the Division of Public Psychiatry, where he is responsible for training resident physicians, social work students, and nurse practitioner students in community mental health. Dr. Betlinski is involved in a variety of leadership and teaching roles, including clinical advisor to the Oregon ECHO Network, program committee chair for the Oregon Psychiatric Physicians Association, and medical director for the Oregon Psychiatric Access Line About Adults, also known as OPAL-A, an outstanding resource available for all of us here in the community. Thank you so much, Dr. Betlinski, for joining us today.
Thank you, everybody, and thank you so much for the invitation to spend an hour with you this morning. We're going to dive right in. We're talking today about recognizing and responding helpfully to anxiety disorders in older adults. In true academic fashion, there are all of my disclosures, which is to say I don't have any, but I will take a moment towards the end of this to shamelessly promote some free resources that are available to you here in the state. Nobody does things in a vacuum, and I owe huge debts to those who have gone before me and helped me learn specifically about today's topic. I want to call out Maggie Bennington Davis and Susan Rose. You'll see some information from the Kaiser Family Foundation, and all of my pictures are from unsplash.com unless otherwise noted. Here's what we're going to accomplish today. I want you by the end of this hour to be able to compare and contrast three ways in which anxiety presents differently in older adults than in younger populations. I want you to be able to describe the content of and the appropriate time to use at least two screening tools for anxiety in older adults, and know the first three steps in treating anxiety in older adults. Here's how we'll get there, but I'm not going to bore you with those details. Instead, we're going to dive right into the numbers because, hey, we got to understand the conversation and the landscape. Now, there's a couple of caveats here that I want to call out right away. There is simply not enough research in anxiety in non-white communities in North America. For example, if we look at OCD in Latino communities, only 1% of OCD study participants in North America have been classed as Latino or Hispanic, and only 11 of all the studies done in OCD have included any participants from the Latino community. If we look at genomic studies, at least 95% of those in genomic studies are of European ancestry, and so it's hard to know based on research what works and what doesn't. Good news, though, in that front, Latino patients may respond better to treatment than white patients. If we step out and we look overall at ethnic variations in anxiety, a 2012 meta-analysis of 541 studies found only 10 studies that included both men and women and compared anxiety levels in migrants and ethnic minorities to that present in natives and ethnic majorities. Four of the five studies showing any difference at all actually found lower anxiety in migrants and ethnic minorities, but the pooled relative risk of all of these studies is 1.01. That's about as close to a no difference as you could possibly find. So research really lags when we're looking at non-white populations and minority populations. But here's the data that we have about anxiety in the USA. Anxiety and depression still remain the most common mental health diagnoses in general medical settings. Anxiety lags a little bit behind depression, but about 30 million Americans have anxiety at any given time, and that costs our economy about $42 billion a year. And here's the part that breaks my heart just a little bit. Maybe on a good day, about one out of three people with an anxiety disorder are known by their primary care provider to have an anxiety disorder. If we look at what anxiety presents in primary care, this comes from a 2007 study of about 15 clinics, and what they found is that one out of five of their patients met criteria for at least one anxiety disorder. PTSD was most common, followed by generalized anxiety disorder, panic disorder, and social anxiety disorder. And another little bit of an alarm bell, two out of five of those with an anxiety disorder had absolutely no treatment for that anxiety disorder. If we look pre-pandemic, anxiety disorders were definitely trending up in the United States of America, but that is disproportionately amongst younger folks. If you look at the group we're talking about today, it was holding steady at around about 4% if we look at 2008 through 2018. Focusing now on anxiety in older adults, If we look at other data sets, it varies a little bit, but somewhere between 3.5% and 10.2% of those over the age of 55 have an anxiety disorder. Most anxiety disorders onset early in life. Think when your age is still in single digits and they get baked in early and they stick around. But some people do develop anxiety later in life. 1 out of 3, for instance, cases of generalized anxiety disorder onset after the age of 50. Risk factors for anxiety in older adults include being female, lower education, being unmarried, and having multiple comorbid health conditions. But this is all data collected before acute thistly-looking little virus entered our world. And almost overnight, the share of adults reporting symptoms of anxiety and or depression quadrupled in the United States of America. And this was mostly anxiety, and interestingly enough, again, mostly in younger folks. But if you look right down here at the very bottom, 65 and up, still about 20%. So you can see that it's about fivefold increase in older adults with anxiety. We're here in Oregon, which remains among the states that has the highest incidence of anxiety or depression right now in our country, with about 1 out of 3 reporting anxiety or depression. So let's look at the impact of that anxiety on our healthcare system or on the patients who try to get help from us. If you have an anxiety disorder, you have an increased risk of hospitalization. You're more likely to use healthcare and use more expensive healthcare. You have an increased risk of chronic illness and physical disability, and you're more likely to have medical symptoms that just defy explanation. You have problems with memory, and increased loneliness, and decreased independence and life satisfaction, and difficulty following your doctor's advice if you're an older adult with anxiety. There's an overlap between anxiety and physical health. We know, for instance, that if you have things like cardiovascular disease or GI disease or respiratory disease or migraines or chronic pain or cancer or a whole variety of things, you're more likely to have an anxiety disorder on your chart. Roughly speaking, the odds of your anxiety disorder increase with increasing length of your problem list. And if we look at the other side as well, that's true. If you have an anxiety disorder on your chart, you're more likely to have some kinds of medical conditions like irritable bowel syndrome or asthma. In general, what you do have has more symptoms, causes more impairment, and progresses more quickly than your cohorts that do not have an anxiety disorder. Anxiety also presents differently in older adults, as if it weren't complicated enough. Anxiety is often expressed as physical symptoms, and sleep disorders or sleep difficulties are much more common in older adults with anxiety than in younger adults with anxiety. You're also more likely to have other psychiatric conditions. For instance, 1 out of 4 cases of major depressive disorder also meet criteria for an anxiety disorder. And of course, dementia, the overlap of dementia and anxiety is quite common. And then there's all the things associated with aging. But if we look at the complaints that people have, if you're an older adult with anxiety, you're more likely than younger folks to be concerned about your health, less likely to be concerned about money or family relationships. You're also less likely to talk about your anxiety. And when you do, it's more likely to be comments like, I'm anxious, or I'm worried, or I'm scared, versus indirect things like I'm embarrassed, or I feel overly guilty about things. Geriatric folks are more likely to report anxiety symptoms that wouldn't be picked up on surveys, and they're less likely to be absolute about things and less commonly report negative emotional states. The good news is that regardless of your age, regardless of the number of comorbid medical conditions that you have, the evidence is pretty clear that people tend to benefit from treating anxiety as much as those with low medical comorbidity. The data around migraines is a little bit squishy, and so I carved that out. Let's talk about what anxiety actually looks like in older adults. We're going to skip over PTSD because that is an entire lecture all to itself, and instead we'll focus on the other anxiety conditions that I mentioned. Generalized anxiety disorder is a disorder that is characterized by excessive anxiety or worry for at least 6 months about a variety of events in a variety of situations, and it's difficult to control that worry, and it's also accompanied by signs of physical hyperarousal, at least 3 of this list of 6, including things like muscle tension or irritability or difficulty concentrating. This is the most common anxiety disorder for older adults, coming in at a prevalence of just under 1%. And remember, that about 1 out of 3 cases of generalized anxiety disorder onset over the age of 55. And so that means by the time, or onset over the age of 50. So that means that by the time we get to the age of 55, about half of those who meet criteria for generalized anxiety disorder had that onset late in life. It's higher risk amongst folks who have hypertension or just overall poor health-related quality of life. Older adults with generalized anxiety disorder tend to worry about a lot of things that are going on in their life right now and less about the future. A panic attack is not in and of itself a psychiatric diagnosis. It's something that can occur in a lot of different situations. And it's basically your adrenal glands releasing all of your stress hormones at the same time. So it's intense fear or discomfort that starts abruptly, peaks in 10 minutes, and includes at least 4 of a lot of things. Here is what a panic attack looks like, at least in the artistic vision of Beth Aisbett, who does a bunch of visual books. I make no money from promoting her, but they're fantastic. The most common thing that people talk about feeling like they're having the first time they have their panic attack is feeling like they have a heart attack. And there's not a way that you can tell looking at somebody whether they're having a panic attack or a heart attack. So if they don't know it's a panic attack, I would treat it as if it's a heart attack to begin with. Panic disorder, on the other hand, is a psychiatric diagnosis that is characterized by recurrent, unexpected panic attacks. And at least one of those attacks has been followed by a month of being worried about the attacks or worried that the attacks are going to disrupt your life in some way, shape, or form, and changing your behavior as a result of that. The good news is, at least where older adults are concerned, that panic disorder almost never starts after the age of 60. And when it does, it's usually related to a stressful event that just happened. For instance, I once took care of a gentleman who developed panic attacks after an injury he sustained while horse riding. It's usually less severe, and it does often get better. If somebody is having panic symptoms rather that wax and wane, you probably should go looking for an underlying medical condition like COPD or something that's contributing to that panic. Social anxiety disorder is basically anxiety that's disabling and that is related to social situations. It could take the form of a panic attack, but most importantly, the person must recognize that this fear is unreasonable and out of proportion to what's going on. They tend to avoid being in that social situation that triggers it, and it really disrupts their life. Phobias, on the other hand, are fear that is disproportionate or unreasonable fear that's related to a very specific thing, like fear of dogs or fear of the number 13. Phobias and social anxiety generally tend to fade out as we go through life, but one common one that you'll see in older adults is fear of falling. I guess if I want to mention a couple of other things, I should mention things like agoraphobia, the fear of being in spaces that are too big. It's sort of the opposite of claustrophobia, and it's not particularly common in older adults. When it is present, it's usually been present for most of their life. And some of you are aware that agoraphobia and panic disorder can cluster together. In older adults, that's usually not the case. Obsessive compulsive disorder is the last one we're going to talk about. And it is a disorder that is characterized by either obsessions, which are thoughts you have to think, even though you don't want to, or compulsions, activities that you must do, even though you don't necessarily want to. Because if you don't think the thought or you don't do the activity, something terrible will happen. That is really uncommon. It presents similarly as it does in younger life. Studies that I can find about this really vary between saying it doesn't happen in older adults at all to maybe up to about 1% over the age of 60, because most people who get OCD early in life get better over the course of their life. In fact, if you do find new onset obsessive compulsive disorder in an older adult, you really should look for dementia or other neurodegenerative conditions. It's almost always a feature of one of those rather than a true de novo OCD. All right, so we've rattled through a lot of disorders very quickly to remind ourselves what exists and what we want to look for in older adults, but let's talk about how to recognize those. We're going to look over 5 screening tools very briefly. We're going to look over the GAD-7, the PDSR, the MINISPIN, the GAS, and the GAI. The CAD-7 is the most common tool that's used for screening for anxiety, and it's a really good tool for screening for anxiety. The problem is that it's absolutely lousy at telling you what kind of anxiety somebody is having. It is based on the diagnostic criteria for generalized anxiety disorder, and it basically asks how often do you meet these criteria. It is really great at picking up generalized anxiety disorder. It's also really great at picking up panic disorder, social anxiety disorder, and PTSD. So just a reminder, if somebody screens positive on the CAD-7, that means they probably have clinically problematic anxiety, but it is not a diagnostic tool. The thing that I love about the GAD-7 is that it's really great at following the intensity of anxiety over time. Scores of 5, 10, and 15 correlate with mild, moderate, and severe anxiety. So it's a really useful tool, but it doesn't tell you necessarily what kind of anxiety somebody's having. The panic disorder self-report, on the other hand, is a complicated little tool that's really good at picking up panic disorder. I mean, it's got 24 different questions on it. Items 1 to 3 must all be yes. Items 1 to 3, 5 to 19, and 22 are 1 point each. And items 20 and 21, you have to divide by 2, and you don't score 4, 23, and 24. It's a really tough little tool to use, but if you think somebody has panic disorder, if they score 8.75 or more, this one's probably diagnostic. And it's really good at being sensitive as well. My favorite tool for picking up social anxiety is the mini spin. Why? Because it's only 3 questions and it's got a sensitivity, great sensitivity and specificity. It is a shorter version of a 17 item spin. One of my favorite tools for obsessive compulsive disorder, and there are several, but I think the easiest one to use is the OCIR. It's 18 Likert scale questions. If you score 21 or more on this, there's a really good chance that you have obsessive compulsive disorder. The challenge of all the screening tools that I've just showed you is that most of the other anxiety screening tools out there as well, is that they were developed for younger adults. And remember, older adults are more likely to talk about things that aren't on any of these tools. There are tools that have been developed for older adults. Lots of them. We're going to focus on 2 of them that I think will make your life a little bit simpler. The first one is the Geriatric Anxiety Inventory. It has 20 yes or no questions. So this one is useful even for folks who have some cognitive deficits because they can still answer yes or no questions. If you score 8 or more on this, it's not particularly sensitive, but it is really specific for problematic anxiety. Again, not particularly diagnostic, but it will tell you, for instance, if somebody has a score of 8 or more, they almost certainly meet criteria for some kind of an anxiety disorder. This one is not great for tracking anxiety over time, so I generally use it once with each patient. If 20 questions are too long, there is a short 5 question version of it that works perhaps even just a little bit better. My favorite tool for tracking anxiety over time in older adults is the Geriatric Anxiety Scale. This is one you can give to somebody to fill out. It's Likert scaled, so it may not work as well for folks who have cognitive challenges. And it tries to get at the 3 domains of anxiety, physical symptoms, interference with your thinking, and emotional expression. Now, the last 5 on this don't actually contribute to the score. They're just designed to give you a flavor of the patient. But if somebody scores 9 or more on the first 25 questions, not super sensitive, but reasonably specific, and as it turns out, a great tracking tool over time. So again, the GAI is a much better screening tool. The GAS is a much better tracking tool over time. Let's talk about how to treat anxiety disorders. There are 3 legs to the stool of treating anxiety disorders. 1, a thorough medical workup. 2, education and lifestyle modification. And 3, behavioral and cognitive approaches. Let's start with a thorough medical workup, which is important for anybody who's having anxiety, but especially important for older adults. You gotta do a good thorough neurologic exam. You don't wanna miss some other neurologic disorder that's going up, and you don't wanna be treating somebody's hyperthyroidism or pheochromocytoma or perhaps carcinoid tumor with an SSRI. Those things are rare, but it's worth looking for. And a reminder that some fairly common conditions like mitral valve prolapse are associated with anxiety disorders as well. Mitral valve prolapse, of course, correlates with panic disorder. It's also important to evaluate for substance abuse. which is one of the great hidden epidemics in older adults. And don't forget about the common things either, like alcohol, caffeine, and nicotine. And since I just got a call on the Oregon Psychiatric Access Line about a 71-year-old who's going through cannabis withdrawal, you should probably really screen for cannabis as well in your older adult patients. At least do a passing screen for other psychiatric disorders as well. Somebody might be terribly anxious because they're actually psychotic, or somebody might be terribly anxious because they are delirious, for instance. As an example of how complicated this can be, look at that big chart over on the right. This is a list of all kinds of conditions and even common medications that are associated with anxiety as features. Look, estrogen, calcium channel blockers, NSAIDs, all associated with causing anxiety in some folks, let alone all the different medical conditions that are on this slide. Some clues that you could use as to whether you need to dig even harder to look for an organic cause of anxiety as opposed to a psychiatric cause of anxiety. If somebody's anxiety genuinely did not start until after age 35, if they have no family history of anxiety or personal history of anxiety disorder earlier in their life, if they haven't had some sort of major life event happen to trigger that anxiety, if they are not avoiding things that are causing anxiety, if they are not, and finally, if they've been to see me and they're not getting any better, I might just send them back to you to say, we really got to dig a lot deeper on this because it isn't behaving like an anxiety disorder behaves. All right, so after we've done a nice, thorough medical workup, the next step is education and lifestyle modification. So we're going to start treating somebody's anxiety right away with a good dose of anxiety, The very first thing that I make sure all of my patients with anxiety disorders know is that anxiety disorders generally get baked in and they generally stick around. So our goal is not to erase your anxiety. Our goal is to give you back your life by managing your anxiety so it no longer interferes with your ability to live, laugh, or love. I could prescribe enough benzodiazepine to get rid of somebody's ability to feel anxiety, but then they might well be a quivering puddle of drool on their couch, and that doesn't feel like a treatment success to me. What I want is for people to be able to live their lives. So we talk about managing anxiety rather than erasing it. The next thing I do is educate people about the cycle of anxiety. We're going to dive more into that on the next slide. And I talk about very basic lifestyle changes that they can make that will lower the likelihood of having disabling anxiety. For instance, regular exercise counteracts anxiety. And by regular exercise, I mean about an hour a day, every day of the week is what we shoot for. But any exercise is better than no exercise. So for some of my patients who are really sedentary, it starts with, okay, once a day, you're going to get out of that chair that you sit in, and you're going to walk around the building that you live in, and you're going to come back inside. If you're not able to walk, let's talk about chair exercises that you can do. And we're going to start with the exercise that you can do, and we're going to build up from there with a goal of getting you to exercising. If we're counting steps for older adults, you really got to get in 6,000 to 8,000 steps a day to begin to see that curve bend a little bit. We also talk about substances like avoiding alcohol, caffeine, and cannabis. And we talk about the importance of getting good sleep. If you're not sleeping enough, you're going to have more stress hormones, you're going to feel more anxiety. And if you do sleep enough, that will start to come down. By the way, enough sleep is 8 to 9 hours a day. And if you're not able to get that, for adults, the bare minimum of sleep is 7 hours a day for minimal functioning. And if you can't get, if you can only get 7 hours a day, the most important thing is you're sleeping for the same 7 hours rather than a different 7 hours every day. So it's more important to have a regular schedule. In other words, you actually do better if you get the same 7 hours of sleep a night than if you get a variable 8 hours of sleep a night. The cycle of anxiety that I hinted at is simply this. If you have anxiety, that increases your alertness. You start scanning the environment for danger more often. You scan your own body and you recognize the physical symptoms that you're having and you tend to magnify them, and your attention really focuses on threats and on you. And that leads you to try to alleviate the anxiety by avoiding or escaping whatever situations cause anxiety. And that's great because you feel better and your anxiety levels go down for a little bit. But that's a problem because it means that anytime you start to get even more reactive to the things that cause it, and you have more worry over time, and that leads to more anxiety, which leads to more scanning of your environment and more focus on your symptoms, which leads to more avoidance, and anxiety tends to spiral over time, both in the short term and the long term. And so really what treatment of anxiety is geared to is disrupting this cycle in some way, shape, or form. And we do that using behavioral or cognitive approaches. Now, this is going to sound a little bit like the lifestyle modification that we already talked about, but it's going to be a little bit more specific. In general, we address behavioral avoidance with gradual exposure. For instance, we'll pick somebody who has a very specific phobia of being on elevators. We're not going to stick them straight on an elevator. That would be exposure therapy, and it's effective, but it can be really, really terrifying. So we might talk about what feelings arise when you think about getting on an elevator, and then we might work up to standing next to an elevator and talking about how that feels and dealing with that. And then we might push a button, but not get on the elevator. And then we might eventually get on the elevator. So that's exposure. In the case of a patient of mine who had OCD and was terrified of going into any room that didn't have the lights at 100%, we addressed that by installing dimmer switches. And so once he could tolerate going into a room with 90%, then he worked on going to a room with 80% lights and so on. So we address behavioral avoidance with gradual exposure. Cognitive distortions get addressed with the evidence. I worked with an older adult who was terrified to drive across railroad tracks because she was quite sure she was going to get hit by a train and die. So I said, oh, okay. Well, how many times in your life have you been hit by a train crossing the railroad tracks? Well, never. Okay, that's an important bit of evidence. How many people in our city die every year from being struck by trains? Well, it was 3 that year. Okay, well, that's important. How many people in the country? And so on. And so we really dove into the data, and so that any time her anxiety began to rise up, she could remind herself, this has never happened to me before. It almost never happens to anybody. And I can do this. And she regained her ability to drive across railroad tracks, which made her life a lot simpler. And we addressed the physical symptoms with things like diaphragmatic breathing and progressive muscle relaxation. We'll talk more about those in a minute. If that's not effective, we're early on going to talk about cognitive behavioral therapy as well. And I'll talk more about that in just a little bit. But first, let's talk about diaphragmatic breathing. Diaphragmatic breathing is amazing stuff. You're basically hacking your own vagus nerve to send feedback back to your brain to let your brain know that you are in a parasympathetic state. It's okay to rest and digest. We don't have to be sympathetically hyper-aroused. So when you do diaphragmatic breathing, it's going to lower heart rate, it lowers blood pressure, it increases the ratio of oxygen to carbon dioxide. So what I recommend to my patients is that you practice this for 5 minutes a day, 5 minutes every morning and 5 minutes every evening, and you do that until you've got it down cold, and then you keep doing that to start and end your day with low anxiety, and then you use it as you need. If you find your anxiety is ramping up during the day, you can remind yourself to switch over to diaphragmatic breathing, or you can excuse yourself and lock yourself in a bathroom stall and sit there for 5 minutes and do diaphragmatic breathing. People will let you have 5 minutes to attend to yourself if you're locked in the bathroom. I've given you links. I hope you'll all have access to these slides, but I've given you links to my favorite teaching tools on diaphragmatic breathing. But in short, I will instruct my patients to put a hand on their chest and a hand on their belly and breathe so that it's the hand on your belly that moves. Or another tip that I give people is when you breathe in, let it all hang out. And when you breathe out, tighten your belly. Diaphragmatic breathing, powerful stuff. I use it myself all the time to deal when I'm feeling stressed as well. The other thing that's really helpful and has a solid evidence base behind it is progressive muscle relaxation. In short, it's a deliberately ordered tensing and relaxation of muscle groups. People often start with their toes and work their way up their body. To give you a sense of how powerful this stuff is, there's a specific kind of therapy that basically teaches you what progressive muscle relaxation is, how to do it, and when to do it. And if I put you through that and you have a panic disorder, there's a 2/3 likelihood that you will be panic-free in just 12 weeks. And if we fast forward to a year, that goes up to 80%. Compare that with full-on cognitive behavioral therapy, and you don't get much more gain by doing that. That is how powerful progressive muscle relaxation is. Here's what I tell people when I assign them to do progressive muscle relaxation. Go to the internet, go to Spotify, find your favorite, or go to YouTube or whatever, find your favorite guided thing and use that. Follow the same order with the same person every time. Use this at bedtime and put it on a regular clock. Let me give you an example here. I had a patient come in and see me who'd had disabling anxiety for the past 10 years. He happened to have a lot of resources, so he had been to see specialists all over the country and tried every medication known to humanity, and nothing was really working for him. And he came and saw me, and I, after doing a nice thorough evaluation with him, I taught him diaphragmatic breathing. And after 5 minutes of that, at the end of the visit, he said, this is the most relaxed I've felt in 10 years. How come nobody ever showed me this before? I didn't have a good reason why nobody had showed him. He had terrible problems falling asleep due to anxiety. He put progressive muscle relaxation in every evening and would fall asleep after just a few minutes of his progressive muscle relaxation ritual. These things work. Cognitive behavioral therapy is really important stuff. The effect of it persists for at least 6 months. Some studies show that it persisting much longer. And interestingly enough, after all of my emphasis on behavioral stuff, the cognitive component of CBT may be the most important part. It is certainly more effective than either supportive therapy or psychodynamic sort of insight-oriented therapy. And it may, and I caution may, because publication bias turns out to be as much at play in studies looking at therapy as those looking at medications, but it may outperform pharmacotherapy. Actually, at the least, the effects of it last longer after it stops than after you stop a medication. It works best for people who are really motivated and interested in doing their stuff. And lest you think that it's not cost effective for the healthcare system to send somebody for a bunch of CBT sessions compared to just putting on a medication, it actually is just a little bit cheaper. Overall, here's what cognitive behavioral therapy looks like. It usually lasts between 6 and 15 sessions. It's usually an hour a week, and it's basically intensive school for learning coping techniques, learning about your disorder, and learning ways to deal with it. It's going to address the thinking-based, the physical-based, and the behavioral symptoms of anxiety. There's a whole list of things I put on here on this slide that might clue you, if your patient is talking about these kinds of things, that they've already gotten CBT. And here's the beautiful part: you don't even necessarily have to see a CBT therapist to do good CBT. I've put a workbook here for primary care settings. You can work through cognitive behavioral therapy following a manual with your patients if you wish to. Okay, the problem is, of course, that here in Oregon right now, we're terribly underserved to meet the need that we have. So what do you do if everybody you're trying to refer your patient to doesn't have availability? Well, there's freely online, freely available, I do speak English, online CBT modules like those at Kelty's Key, that are available for your patients and have been carefully vetted and shown to be effective. One of my favorite other online resources for self-help comes to us out of Western Australia. So there's plenty of resources available. I also mentioned workbooks already. Sometimes what I do is I send my patients down to their favorite bookstore, to the self-help section, and ask them to find a workbook on anxiety that seems like it would work for them, and to work through that and to report back to me. The caveat when you're doing workbooks or online modules for CBT is you've got to master the stuff in chapter one or module one before you move on to module two. This is not the kind of thing where you sit down and you read the book and you're like, yes, I've got it. These books are chock full of very practical exercises that you must go through, worksheets that you have to fill out, things that you got to think about and work on. And each chapter builds on the chapter that came before it. So again, master the stuff in chapter one before you move on to chapter two. Let's talk about pharmacology for older adults. Now, it gets tricky, because as you're well aware, our bodies change as we age and grow. And so when we're thinking about prescribing medications for older adults, we have to think about things like normal changes in physiology. People generally have increased distribution of medications and decreased metabolism and clearance of medications compared to younger folks. And they often achieve higher serum levels because of that, higher serum levels at the same dose. And generally, medications just don't clear as quickly. This becomes particularly problematic when we're thinking about things with long half-lives, like diazepam, for instance. The other thing that I think is really important to think about with older adults is that they're just more sensitive to anticholinergic effects than our younger folks. And it's really easy to inadvertently have somebody on several medications that have mild anticholinergic effects that add up to big anticholinergic effects. And now we have somebody who's constipated or can't pee or has problems with their thinking. We have to also have to factor in medical comorbidities and the fact that most of us over the course of our lives tend to take more and more and more medications, and those can interact with each other. And then, of course, there's the challenges that older adults have with losing some of their functioning as they go through life, or some of them do. So here's my short one-page cheat sheet for thinking about medications in older adults with anxiety. In general, your favorite SSRIs and SNRIs are safe and effective for generalized anxiety disorder, for obsessive compulsive disorder, for panic disorder, and even for PTSD. I know I said I wouldn't talk about it, but there it is. All right. So the caveat that you have to remember is that SSRIs, the evidence that SSRIs are helpful for anxiety is actually more convincing than the evidence that SSRIs are helpful for depression. But you often have to push the dose higher than you would to get a response for depression. So I'll pick on a common one like sertraline. Sertraline in depression in older adults has never shown additional benefit above 150 milligrams, at least if you look at the data in toto. But for anxiety, there is evidence that going up to 200 milligrams may be more helpful than 150 milligrams. If somebody is not responding, that doesn't mean the medication doesn't work for them. It may mean that you need to push the dose a bit higher, provided that they're not having side effects that would render that intolerable. I generally avoid tricyclic antidepressants in older adults. Why? They are certainly effective. The evidence there is persuasive, but I've just run into too many folks who have problems with anticholinergic effects or with cardiotoxic effects. Enough times earlier in my career, I nudged people over into congestive heart failure at very low doses of TCAs that's not first line for me. If somebody has done well on a TCA in the past, I might try it, or if they're not responding to an SSRI or SNRI and seem otherwise healthy, I'll go for it. Buspirone is a medication that is FDA approved for the treatment of anxiety in adults. And that's about all it's approved for. Just a reminder that it seems to work pretty well in generalized anxiety disorder, but at least in older adults, in the very limited data that's available, it doesn't seem to have any benefit for panic disorder. Benzodiazepines are really wonderful agents for anxiety. They work so well, and they're really great for acute anxiety or for short-term anxiety. I would strongly encourage you with your older adults to really time limit the length of time you would use a benzodiazepine. And if they already come to you on a benzodiazepine and they've been on it for a long time, start tapering them off it. The evidence is pretty clear that for older adults, long-term use of benzodiazepines, the problems associated with that far outweigh any potential for benefits. And in my experience, and this is backed up by the data, no matter how long somebody has been on a benzo, no matter how many decades they've taken it, once you get them weaned off, they will do better than they did. Now, you might have to wean very slowly. If somebody is on 4 milligrams of clonazepam a day, you might, and has been on that for more than a year, you might wean them by only a quarter of a milligram every month. It might just be slow and general. When we're talking about younger adults and weaning benzos, we often talk about when you get to lower doses, switching over to diazepam and continuing to lower there. I discourage the use of diazepam in older adults. It just has way too many active metabolites, and the half-life is incredibly variable, and you can inadvertently make somebody terribly delirious and confused, even at doses that don't alleviate their anxiety over time. The other place that I would avoid benzodiazepine use is if somebody has dementia, or as Sue Rose, who I mentioned earlier, says, if somebody's really confused, would you give them a shot of whiskey to help them clear up their thinking? No, you wouldn't. So don't give a delirious or a demented older adult a benzodiazepine in hopes that it's going to make things better. It almost always makes things worse. The other caveat for me when I'm thinking about medications with older adults is, given how robust the data is that therapy is effective, if somebody's anxiety is bad enough that we're going to use a medication and take on the risks of side effects, then I'm looking to refer them to psychotherapy or to engage in psychotherapy myself with them. A couple of thoughts about anxiety and dementia. A reminder that in neuropsychiatric symptoms of dementia, the evidence is very clear that the best treatments are those that are behavioral and environmental, not those that are medication in nature. But if we're talking about medications in somebody who has both anxiety and dementia, here's my rule of thumb. If the anxiety occurred before the dementia started, go ahead and treat the anxiety like you would treat anxiety. Consider using an SSRI and going there. However, if the dementia started before the anxiety, or if the dementia started at the same time as the anxiety, focus your medication therapy on treating the anxiety, or treating the dementia, not the anxiety. And here, I like memantine because of its NMDA receptor antagonism. It tends to be anxiolytic as well as helping improve cognitive functioning. So maybe think about that. There is some evidence. There's lots of things we've tried along the way, low-dose trazodone and low-dose antipsychotics. I would avoid those unless there's no other thing. There is some growing evidence that prazosin may be helpful, particularly if you think that behavioral disturbances in dementia are driven by anxiety, by sympathetic hyperarousal. So consider trying that. And again, I would avoid benzodiazepines for anyone who has dementia, especially for behavioral disturbances in dementia, because you're just more likely to disinhibit them and make that worse. If this all sounds terribly complicated, it can be, but it doesn't have to be. So this is the part where I get to shamelessly promote services that are available to you and every other medical provider in the state of Oregon. The Oregon Psychiatric Access Line is a hotline that is funded by your tax dollars. It's a part of the Oregon Health Authority, and it is geared for you or anybody with the ability to prescribe medications in the state of Oregon to call and talk with a psychiatrist in real time about a patient of yours and get some ideas on how to move forward with that patient. It can be a medication question, it can be a resources question, it can be anything related to behavioral health. That is a free service. It is already paid for. You're not going to get a bill for it. Your patient isn't going to get a bill for it. Their insurance is not going to get a bill for it. We have at least three psychiatrists on duty, and that is their clinical assignment to take your phone call. So you are not pulling them away from anything else. They exist in that brief moment of time simply to help you and will stay on the phone with you as short or as long as you want to. There's another service that OPAL offers as well, and that is if you have questions about your own behavioral health, or you just had a terrible day and you need to talk to somebody about you or about what's happened to you, you can call and identify that as well. There are no records kept of those phone calls. We just track how many of them come in over time. And that's in contrast, of course, if you call about one of your patients, we'll send you a lovely write-up about that and some additional resources after the phone call. The other service that I want to make sure you know about is the Oregon Echo Network. That is a place where you can get free continuing education credit and maintenance of certification credit do case-based, high-yield, evidence-based learning about a variety of topics. Here's the ones that are coming up starting in April. You can still sign up for those. There's a Foundations of Gender-Affirming Care, a Parkinson's Echo, Diabetes, how to lead employee well-being efforts. There's one for dentists, which is probably less relevant here. There's a bunch about substance use disorders, and there's six communities of practice, which are ongoing case-based learning, so you can bring your real-world cases and benefit from those. And I also flagged some mental health-related ones that are coming up. Again, the older adult-focused one that I'm really excited about is deprescribing for older adults, how to whittle down the medication list for your older adult patients. Again, these are completely free to you. Some of these are funded by the state, some by various grants and things like that. And then finally, I also wanted to let you know about the mental health clinical advisory group. There we go. This is a group that exists within OHA, and they're busy sorting through all of the data and putting out various treatment guides. So if you go to their website or just search MHCAG and OHA, you will come up with their treatment recommendations as well. And of course, we at OPAL closely collaborate with them. In summary, today, anxiety in older adults is not as common in younger groups, but it is common enough that we need to pay attention to it. It often presents with different concerns, more likely to be related to other things that are going on in somebody's life, and of course, often complicated by typical aging. But we can do a better job of recognizing it if we use efficient screening tools like the GAI or the GAS, the Geriatric Anxiety Inventory, or the Geriatric Anxiety Scale. And when we do recognize it, treatment begins with a thorough medical workup, followed by education and lifestyle modification, cognitive and behavioral approaches, and maybe an SSRI or an SNRI. There's a quick look at all the research that was consulted in putting together this topic. That's the time that I have. I'll now take questions.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Betlinski, for a wealth of information and a short amount of time. Any questions here in the room? While people are pondering, I'll go ahead and start with a question or two from online. Dr. Betlinski, I am not sure if you're familiar with the recent article in JAMA on increased mortality among those taken off benzodiazepines after long-term therapy.
I'm not familiar with that particular article, and so I would need to defer and look at that. But what I will say is that, at least in my own personal anecdotal experience, I have not had anybody die after taking them off of benzodiazepines. My concern with weaning people off benzodiazepines is that we often try to do it too quickly. And so I would say that if somebody's been on benzodiazepines for a long time and they do make the decision to wean them off that, I would go super slow on that and be super patient about that. Then you'll avoid that risk. Now, you, of course, can make your own decision. Every patient is different, and you can decide whether or not it's worth weaning them off. But if they're having problems with anything that could be exacerbated by a benzo, thinking or falls or whatever else, then I think you probably clinically got to work on weaning them down on that. As I tell my patients, once you've been on a benzodiazepine for long enough, I can no longer tell if the benzodiazepine is treating your anxiety or if it's just treating its own withdrawal. Because clinically, there's no difference in how somebody presents between having an anxiety disorder or benzodiazepine withdrawal, which is characterized by all the same kinds of things. And so I don't think I'm being a good doctor if I'm putting you on something that's causing more problems than it's alleviating. But make your own decisions. I see a hand in the back. Wait, we got a microphone coming to you.
Two questions. The first is, if we have our older patient who's maybe had some little bit of anxiety, is there any reason not to use an SSRI and Namenda?
Yes, there might be. One easy example is if they have a psychotic disorder, Namenda just might make that worse. So if their anxiety is arising from psychotic symptoms, you might want to rethink the Namenda issue and stick with an acetylcholinesterase inhibitor. Two is this. I think you have to factor in who they are. Remember that SSRIs have their own side effects, particularly the anticholinergic ones, which could interfere with thinking. You can give somebody orthostatic hypotension. You might increase their risk of falls. So I think that if somebody has a cognitive or mild cognitive deficits and anxiety, and it's not really clear which started first, you're not wrong to try to treat it both directions, and I would be extra hypervigilant about monitoring for side effects.
Great. And then my second question is, sometimes my patients have come back from seeing mental health prescribers, and they are on antipsychotics and or antiepileptics, and they didn't make it into your talk.
So one of the challenges I think that we have when our specialties are talking is that I want you to know every possible thing about everything, and there's not enough time to do that. I think you're right to ask questions about anti-epileptics and antipsychotics. Those are the big guns that we psychiatrists tend to pull out when nothing else is working. There is evidence that things like gabapentin or lamotrigine or pregabalin, things that work on the GABA glutamate system, can be potentially very helpful for treating anxiety. None of them have ever been FDA approved for use in anxiety. And so if your patient is on something like that and it's helpful for their anxiety and the benefits are outweighing any problems associated with it, I say go for it and consider titrating it if needed. Other anti-epileptics, I think, often cause more problems in older adults than in benefits. So things like topiramate or carbamazepine or oxcarbazepine really can can cause a lot of cognitive side effects, especially valproic acid is famous for doing that. So I tend to avoid those where I can, but if somebody has a bipolar disorder and needs that to be in place in addition to their anxiety, you might see it. As far as antipsychotics, most of them are powerfully anxiolytic, and they are definitely not first-line treatment for anxiety disorders. But they do get used, and they might be used to augment an antidepressant, for instance, or they might be used to augment treatment for OCD or things like that. What I would say is that if your patient is on an atypical antipsychotic, I would want to do a couple of things. I would want to look at that dose and see, does that dose look reasonable? 25 milligrams of quetiapine isn't treating anything, but it is giving somebody anticholinergic effects and making them very sleepy. And so if somebody is going to be on one, let's have it on a dose that's reasonable for whatever condition they're on, and let's monitor carefully to make sure that the benefits are outweighing the risks.
Dr. Belansky, I have three questions. The first one is about your comment on this first slide about Latino patients have just are very at risk for anxiety disorder. Do we have specific questionnaires or screening tool that is specific for that populations? Or the idea is that you can just translate what we have in terms of GOT7, our treatment plan, and then it will translate.
The good news is that these screening tools that I've talked about have all been vetted in multiple cultural contexts and are then assumed to work in other ones as well. And all of the ones that I presented are available in Spanish. And so they should work just as well. Or if you use them with a translator, they should. They're fairly concrete questions and they should work about as well. Interestingly enough, the research that is available in Latina communities suggests that anxiety is more likely in first generation immigrants than in second generation immigrants. And folks who are Latino are more likely to seek out care, at least in this country, from non-traditional healthcare sources than from traditional healthcare workers. But when they do, they are more likely to respond to treatment than our comparative Caucasian populations. And so there's every reason to screen for anxiety and to treat it when it's present. Folks will likely respond.
Yeah, thank you. And my second question is, the United States Preventative Service Task Force has recommended annual screening of anxiety in all adults. Do you support that recommendation?
I do. That my frustration with annual screening is that often annual screening is the GAD2, like annual screening for depression is the PHQ-2, not the PHQ-9. And it's just a reminder that if somebody scores positive on one of those, the recommendation is always to follow up with the full screening tool, not just to accept that they have that diagnosis. So the PHQ-2 and the GAD-2 are great general screening tools, but they're lousy at telling you that something is actually there.
And my last question, I will ask with a caveat that I am an intern, so a new doctor, but in the hospital, I have had multiple times where patient is breathing at 35 breaths per minute, heart rate is rising, and the word anxiety comes up. And can somebody without a general anxiety disorder diagnosis before going to the hospital be so anxious because of the fact that they are in the hospital to the point where they are hemodynamically changing on me?
Yes, of course. Absolutely. So being hospitalized for most of us is an inherently stressful and scary situation. And so not surprising that people's anxiety levels are often higher in an inpatient world than they are in an outpatient world. Of interest, you mentioned respiratory rates. People, for instance, who have anxiety tend to have higher resting respiratory rates than the rest of us do. Panic disorder, the average resting respiratory rate for folks who have panic disorder is 18. And so anything we can do to help somebody slow down or to temporarily alleviate their anxiety during their stay in the hospital is likely to be helpful. Having anxiety in the hospital doesn't necessarily mean that they need to be on a medication for anxiety outside of the hospital.
Mm-hmm. Great. Another question here online. Thank you for drawing the connection between a new tentative diagnosis of anxiety in an older adult and being mindful of perhaps a new cognitive impairment on the horizon. If that person were to screen normal on a cognitive screen, are there any other clues that you look for to think that this might be an impending cognitive diagnosis in somebody presenting as anxiety?
Yeah, you know, it's a tough thing because, of course, when you have anxiety, your brain doesn't work as well. You tend to be more forgetful, and so you may well score on cognitive or as showing cognitive impairment. So I think it's important to track cognitive status using your favorite tool, the SLUMS or the MoCA or whatever you want, in somebody who has an anxiety disorder, because I bet you'll see that functioning get better. If the functioning does not get better as their anxiety lowers, that's a big clue that there might be something else going on. If somebody is scoring otherwise well on cognitive testing, but has anxiety, how might you know whether this is the very early stages of a dementia? Well, that's going to be hard to do unless you want to send somebody for exhaustive neuropsychiatric testing. But some basic clues are paying attention to the kinds of things that they forget. Somebody getting lost in a very familiar place might score very well still on cognitive exams, but that's a bit ominous. Somebody having difficulty recalling names or of people who are very familiar to them, or people forgetting things about themselves, are a little bit more ominous than somebody who's having sort of global forgetfulness. But again, none of those are diagnostic tools. Those are just things that might make you want to pay more attention.
I very much appreciate the specific ideas that you had for explaining to patients who are requesting benzos or want to stay on their benzos. And I just want to push you to make sure you don't have any other tricks, because we often find these patients bolt, or that do you have any other tricks even for treating them as we're trying to taper the benzos? Anything else you have? Because explaining hasn't always worked for me.
It doesn't. Sometimes I will pull out a study and hand it to somebody and let them see evidence. But the other thing that I default to is, I default to two other things. If nothing else is working, I will default to one of two things. I will remind people that the DEA and the Oregon Medical Board monitor my prescription of benzodiazepines. And my desire to keep being available to help other people and continue to be a doctor outweighs their individual belief on what's going to work well for them. And so I have to make sure that what I'm doing is reasonable. Clonazepam has only been FDA approved for the treatment of anxiety up to 4 milligrams a day. You're on 8 milligrams a day. I can't keep doing that. I'm putting my medical license at risk. Now, what would not make it at risk is if we're demonstrating that we're working on getting you back to a reasonable dose. Now, maybe I'm not going to win that war and get them all the way down to zero, but I can at least maybe work on getting them back to something that is more reasonable. The other thing that I'll default to also is just, I don't want to be a bad doctor. And so I would feel like I was being a bad doctor if, or God forbid, something should happen to me and I die and you get transferred to one of my other colleagues. I would be so embarrassed if they found out that this is what we were doing. Really? You'd be embarrassed? I would be mortified if they knew that this is what I'm doing. Oh, okay. What, right? So I will make somebody else the bad guy, who's not them and who's not me, and sort of bring that other third person into the room with us, metaphorically speaking, to watch over what we're doing and anything I can do to nudge us again back to more reasonable treatment. I do not think that you are going to get everybody who's been on 5 milligrams of alprazolam a day for the last 30 years off their benzo. But you might be able to get them over to something more reasonable, something with something like clonazepam or lorazepam that has a little bit longer effectiveness, as opposed to a half-life, and doesn't suddenly leave them withdrawing medication, right? Or you might at least be able to switch them from alprazolam to alprazolam XR, so that they're not taking multiple doses a day, and so that they're getting a more steady state in their system.
Great. Thank you so much. We are coming right to the top of the hour. Thank you, Dr. Betlinski, for your talk and all your service in the community. We can work to get the slides attached to the follow-up email that goes out where folks can claim CME credit. So watch there for all the great resources and tools suggested. Thank you.
Perfect. Thanks, everybody.
Something like that. Can I still? You can die. There you go. I just want to say it was nice to get rid of that. Oh my gosh, I didn't see you.